This is Galactic Chat, Australian Author Interviews. And I'm joined today by Marianne De Pierre, who's well known in the Australian speculative fiction community as one of our rare science fiction novelists of the 21st century. She's the author of the Parish Placey action-adventure series and, more recently, the feminist space opera series Sentience of Orion. And under the name Marianne Delacourt, has also written the Tara Sharp series of humorous crime novels. She recently had a boutique collection of short stories called Glitter Rose, published by 12th Planet Press. Marianne has now turned her hand to paranormal YA fantasy with Burn Bright, the first book of the Night Creatures trilogy. Marianne, thank you for talking to me.
Tansy, lovely to hear your voice.
Oh, it's nice to have an excuse, really, to chat, isn't it?
Indeed it is. You're way too far away.
I am, and so are you. Okay, well, to get started, we're mainly going to talk about Burn Bright. Can you briefly explain, to kick us off, what Burn Bright is all about and what's the story?
I'm really terribly bad at encapsulating my own novels in one sentence, but I will try. Burn Bright is, I suppose it could be classified as dystopian YA fantasy, but it's kind of more than that as well. It's science fictional for a start. It doesn't probably easily fall into any of the categories of current YA fiction. The story essentially is about a young girl who has living in a very repressed society where to the point where, you know, young people aren't allowed to gather in groups, they're not allowed to listen to music, they're not allowed to read books, this kind of incredibly controlled environment. Her brother runs away to this mysterious island called Ixion. And Ixion is a place where the people that run the island, called Ripers, promise that there are no rules and that it is a very free environment and that people can, the young people that run away there can just be themselves and go to parties and not sleep. So her brother can't bear this terribly repressed environment he's in, and he runs away there, and without him she's completely lost. So the story itself of Burn Bright follows her having to escape her own home and go to Ixion, and then it looks at the sort of sinister side of this supposedly free society that's actually not quite what it seems. It's a coming-of-age story, but it's a whole lot of other things as well. And that was probably a very convoluted explanation.
Definitely wasn't one sentence. But that's okay. I forgive you. It's very interesting novel because it's quite light and fast-paced and a lot more fun, I have to say, than you made it sound. But it does have these deeper themes to it. Now, you don't actually use the V word in your book, but there is a little bit of vampire-ish. The iconography you use, you know, it's more something that you hint at, that there are elements of vampire mythology in the book. Was it something that you were keen to, I suppose, do something different with? Because, as you know, there are a lot of, you know, going back to the V word in YA, is it something that you're sort of trying to, I don't know, do something different with?
I wouldn't say I was exactly subverting vampires, but I consciously did not want to write a story about vampires. I felt that I didn't have anything new to offer and anything fresh. But I do love all the tropes associated with vampire mythology, and so, and I, you know, I guess I was channeling the inner goth a little, in that I just found it, the idea of writing about deserted churches on an island that's in perennial darkness, incredibly attractive. But you know, bats and a lot of the things that you will find in vampire literature are present in the book, but as you know, when you, Tansy, because you read the book and you've gotten to the end, that that actually they're not vampires at all.
No, there's sort of like a vampire-sized hole in the book, really, because you've got everything. You've got bats, you've got the blood, you've got velvet churches, as you say. You know, there's so many
black
of
lace.
The tropes, black lace. I'd say when I was trying to encapsulate the book, I was about to describe it as gothic fantasy, and I thought, now, hang on, gothic fantasy sort of implies, you know, the whole Jane Eyre with magic kind of thing. It's the other kind of gothic. It's the gothic that we sort of think of when we think of teenagers. And that whole nightclub aspect. But, yeah, there aren't actually vampires in it. So it's very interesting. Is that something that you're... I mean, are you worried that the book will get labelled as a vampire book, or is it a good thing if people think that's what it is?
Look, if, you know, I mean, very early on in my writing days, I gave up worrying about what would happen between my text and the reader. I mean, what they create out of it is really up to them. Certainly it wasn't my intention for people to see the Ripers as vampires, but they have vampiric tendencies, I guess. But as you know, when you get to the end of the book, you find out that it's something quite different. So I'm really not worried how people interpret it. It's entirely up to them, as long as they get pleasure from it and it provokes some reaction in them.
Okay, so you mentioned that Burn Bright is a little bit science fictional. Now, again, you know, we don't want to get too close into how it may be science fictional, because I think finding out about that is, you know, one of the pleasures of the book. But is science fiction in YA something that you think still has to be maybe, you know, wrapped up in vampire tropes? Is it something people need to have sneaked into the diet? or is there, you know, is there room for science fiction in YA?
Oh, I think probably more room for science fiction in YA than adult fiction almost. I think YA readers are so much more open to any kind of story as long as it's a good story. Certainly in this case, in the case of Burn Bright, I actually started out wanting to write a dark fantasy, and as I wrote the story, it just became science fictional. I just couldn't help myself. So it says actually a lot more about me than anything else. I think, and just from talking to some of the people who have read it already, the younger readers that I've had to this point, probably doesn't even cross their mind that it's science fiction as such. They don't need that label.
Mm. Well, that's the good thing, I suppose, about YA is that once you've got YA on there, it transcends other genre labels, and you have
absolutely
more freedom in that.
Which is quite delightful, I have to say.
Writing about music is a very, very difficult thing to do. I mean, a lot of people struggle with it, especially writing for teenagers, and yet music is a really strong theme throughout the book. Basically, you've got kids living in a 24-hour nightclub with occasional
rave.
it's this giant ongoing never-ending rave. So how did you approach that idea of writing about music? Is it something that you struggled with, or is it something that came naturally into the text?
Well, you know, I was young once. you know, music's always been a huge part of my life. I have three teenagers, well, actually one teenager and two 20-year-olds, and music's a huge part of their life, and it just seemed it would have been almost impossible to write a story about teenagers for me without music in it. So a large part of it is based on my own personal relationship with music. But also trying to make sure that translates into something quite relevant today. So, and probably my sons, not that I sat down and talked to them about it, but, you know, I listen to their music. I talk to them about the concerts they go to, you know, as any mother does. So I tried to make it relevant, but the heart of it, the main character's interaction with the music was definitely something that came from my own perspective on, you know, how I feel about music.
Okay, well, that leads us very nicely into this really fascinating collaboration that you have been doing with Yunyu.
Lovely Yunyu.
Yeah, who has recently released a single onto iTunes. which ties directly into your novel, and you've got the cross-promotion thing going. So tell me about Angelarias as a single and how this came about.
I met Yunya a few years ago through Supernova and a few mutual acquaintances, and we, you know, we got talking and the subject came up of possibly collaborating on something, and at the time Burnbright wasn't a finished manuscript, and I said to her, well, look, I don't really have anything that, knowing Yunya's kind of music and the sorts of things she was interested in, I didn't think I had anything that was particularly right. But I said to her at the time, look, when I have a project that I feel might interest you, I'll be in contact. So a bit of time passed before that happened, probably at least a year or so, and I finally finished the Burnbright manuscript and I sent it to her. And I don't know whether you've listened to Yunya's other music, but she is described as the queen of morbid pop, which is quite a lovely title.
That's really appropriate for this book.
It is. her reaction was what I had hoped, was that it was her kind of story. And she went away, and I only found out recently, she wrote three songs in reaction to Burnbright, and she did that in a period of 2 weeks, and she was actually moving house, which was, you know, writing three songs in 2 weeks is pretty full on anyway for a musician, but while you're moving house, she said it nearly killed her. But she came back with these three amazing songs, and the difficult thing then was to actually choose one, because while we would love to have put out an album of songs for the first novel, I mean, realistically, we just couldn't afford it. So we agreed in the end that we would release the one song, and then we had to go through the whole process of contracts and getting, you know, three organisations, as in myself, Yunya, and publishers to sort of agree on a whole bunch of things. So that was actually quite a drawn-out process, but we got there. And I think, well, Tansy, you've heard the song. What did you think?
I have. It was... I really enjoyed listening to it. It's not something that I, you know, have... I said I haven't listened to any of your new music before. I was really quite blown away with it, especially because I hadn't, at the time I listened to the song, read the published version of Burnbright. But as you know, I read it a couple of times before it was published in manuscript form, so I knew the sort of thing we were looking for. And my first thought was just, wow, these two things really fit together so well. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's how I felt about it when I heard it. Was just, you know, because I was a little nervous when Yunya bought it. I was in Sydney, and she came over with her neat little speaker set and set it up and played it. And, you know, I was a little nervous because, you know, if it hadn't worked, I wasn't quite sure what we would do then. But I was just, it was fabulous.
Yeah.
And, I think you know when you're collaborating instinctively whether something's right or not, and it was just such a great feeling to know that it was exactly what I was hoping it would be.
It must have been a big relief too.
Certainly an aspect of relief, but, you know, even down to the lyrics, when I look, I've got the lyrics up on the website now, and I just think, wow, you know, the lyrics to the song are so good, I want to use them in the book.
Is this collaboration something that you're going to be taking any further, or is it just going to be this one song for the first book of the trilogy?
Well, I guess it'll be a wait-and-see thing. As I mentioned, there's the financial considerations. You know, creatively, both of us would love to continue to either release an album for the whole series or at least one single per book, but we have to wait and see how it's received and whether it's financially viable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one thing I would like to add is that one of the great things about working in collaboration with a creative person from another genre or platform is the fact that she was, like, I didn't have to spoon feed her. I just gave her the book. She went away and created something to the point that she even, in the first couple of pages or the first chapter of the book, a song is mentioned called Angel Arias, and it's a calling song. It's the code that the people from Ixion call the young people to the island. But that's all. There's no other context for it. So Yunyu actually went away and made her whole own backstory up so she could create the song around it. And I didn't know this at the time, and subsequently we talked about it just recently, in fact, and her reason, the backstory she created is actually a perfect backstory, and she agreed I could use it in the next book.
Oh. Well, I mean, you've already then got your, well, you've got your money's worth. How wonderful to be able to take that out. I mean, I suppose in some ways it's a little similar to when somebody does an extraordinary piece of cover art, if that kind of feeds back, but it's, yeah, doing your own thing separately, there's that little bit more independence.
Yeah, I think it's important not to stifle the other person's creativity, and I think possibly that can, I mean, I'm not experienced in collaborating with other writers, but I'm sure that that could potentially be an issue when writer collaborates with writer. But when you're collaborating with someone from another medium, you know, I mean, I couldn't begin to, pretend to know anything about how to write music. Mm. So I was quite content for her to do her thing and trust her to do her thing. And, you know, it was from that point of view, it was just a really, really, really good experience. I actually contacted Kevin J. Anderson when Yunyu and I first agreed to go ahead with it, because he had just released an album for his most recent series. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, a group of independent musicians who are all quite well known in their own right got together and recorded the album for him. And he said to me, then you will have the best time of your life doing this. And I really did. He was right.
Oh, well, that's great. I mean, at least then, regardless of how it turns out, it's been a successful artistic experiment.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, end of the day, that's probably more important than anything, Tansy, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's wonderful. Okay, well, we touched upon this a little bit before. I want to talk a little bit about YA as a genre and the challenge for an adult writer, regardless of whether they were very young once, but, you know, in capturing an authentic teenage voice for readers of a different generation. And no matter what age you are when you start writing, chances are very likely if you're writing YA, if you're actually a teenager yourself, you're in a different generation to your readers. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was reading Burn Bright, I thought the voices came really naturally off the page. But of course, I'm no spring chicken myself anymore, so my opinion on that doesn't really count. But, you know, it felt very natural, but it can't be that easy. So how do you find that? Is it a matter of just remembering back to your teenage years, or observing your sons secretly when they're not looking, or what else? How do you do it?
Well, I guess the thing about writing fantasy, I mean, I wasn't writing a story set in the contemporary world. So I had a few let-offs there, in the sense that I wasn't having to create dialogue that was necessarily idiosyncratically now. You know, my characters come from another place. So I could, in a sense, create their own voice, even, you know, obviously keeping in mind the fact that they're of a certain age, but I didn't have to use current slang words. I didn't have to use current expressions, which will date also very quickly. So I think that was the absolute beauty about writing something that wasn't contemporary. And on top of that, I tried to, I mean, you know, I do listen to young, I think listening is the key to dialogue. You need to listen to the way people talk. Then how you write it is a little, that's a different thing again, but unless you've got an ear for it in the first place, you can't translate it well. I don't know if that explains particularly well what I'm trying to say, but
It makes sense. And I have to say, I loved I'm a sucker for made-up slang. I loved some of the terms and phrases you had in the book, and the fact that different kids that came from different places had different expressions. Yep. And, you know, I think everybody's going to be saying baby bats. I love that one.
Thanks, Jans. Actually, a lot of that came... a lot of my confidence to do that came from Zoe Walton, my publisher, because in the in the text, as we were going through the editing process, I had some made up words, but I also had some slang expressions that were contemporary, because I wasn't quite sure, and she was the one that gave me confidence to say, no, you need to be authentic with your worlds, and let's get rid of some of these contemporary swear words and replace them with others. And I think she was absolutely right in the end, as I look back at it now. So again, that in terms of getting the dialogue right, that all helped. I was able to make up my own words.
Well, I suppose all or nothing, really, if you're going to do something like that.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And I was sort of, I guess I was sort of falling halfway in between at one stage in the writing of the book, and, you know, she was able to give me confidence to go where my instinct wanted to go.
Hmm. All right, well, a topic I often see coming up over and over in discussions of YA is the question of how dark is too dark.
Hmm.
What lines you draw in books aimed at teenagers. Did you find yourself filtering any of the choices you made for this book because it was for a younger audience, or is it just the age of the protagonist that makes it YA?
Well, yes, to the first part of your question, I did actually filter one particular scene, and I'm not sure if you can remember that because you
I
read
remember the scene.
Well, I had there is a scene in the book where, which is quite a violent scene, where Retra has something physically removed from her. That scene was a lot more brutal, and I went through several writes with that in, and when I eventually submitted it, I took it out. I just felt probably partly your reaction to it initially, which was, you know, your reaction was pretty I talked it over with my agent as well, and in the end I felt that was going too far. I don't really want to go into the detail of what it was, but I did make a conscious choice at that point. And when I submitted it to Random House and we went through the rewrite process, I did at one stage mention to Zoe that I had this other scene, and we discussed what was in it, and she said, no, you've made the right call. So... it's not, well, certainly for me, it is not just about the age of the protagonist, although that is definitely a way that people classify literature as young adult. But I believe that most authors with some kind of, any kind of sense of responsibility do filter to some extent. And I was conscious, and even now I'm conscious in the marketing of it, that... it's a book that I'm more comfortable talking to year 10, 11 and 12 about, and really would not be terribly comfortable with the idea of year 7, 8 and 9 kids reading it.
Yeah, well, I have to say that scene as it is now in the published book, and anybody who reads the book will know what scene we're talking about, it's still pretty brutal. I mean, it's a very... I don't think anybody who reads the book is going to accuse you of pulling your punches, because it is a very visceral scene.
Yep.
And I don't think it loses anything from being perhaps a little bit less...
Yeah, graphic.
...brain exploding and graphic. You know, it's still pretty graphic. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. It's still it's a very effective scene. But, yeah, it's interesting, that thing of what line you draw, because I think it would be individual not only for the author but for the book and... It's choices. Yeah.
Well, that was part of the reason that I made the decision to take it out, because I thought, do I need this to be this way to get my point across? And I thought, no, I actually don't. I can achieve this point without going quite this far and possibly having the book banned.
Yeah. Which, you know, Sometimes having books banned is
it's a good thing.
Is a good thing, and sometimes it's, well, not that it's good to be banned, but sometimes it can be a good thing for sales, and just sometimes it's not. So,
yeah, that's right. I certainly wasn't going to make the decision based on that.
I think the worst thing would be to try and be controversial for the sake of it.
For the sake of it,
some
absolutely.
People wander into it, and that's a whole different thing.
I love that expression. Wander into it is beautiful, yeah.
Wander into controversy.
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to talk a bit about social media because you in particular, I think, are one of the busiest and most in-touch authors that I see around the internet. And, you know, you work across a lot of different platforms. You talk to people in a lot of different areas. You spend a lot of time at conventions. I mean, like you mentioned Supernova already. That's not a convention that's normally, I think, known for its fiction quotient, but you've kind of got in there and made some of it being about fiction. I want to talk a little bit about, as an author, is this something that you feel there's a responsibility to be that available and to try and reach people in so many different social media platforms and that sort of thing. How much work is it?
Yeah, look, I mean, to be honest, to me, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy that side of it. It's not a chore. It's not something I do simply because I'm chasing readership. I enjoy social media. I enjoy the interaction with the people. I mean, as you know, it's bloody boring and lonely at home.
Yeah.
But I also, and I've actually just written a little blog piece for one of the Angus and Robertson franchises on this. I really do believe that the era of the reclusive, antisocial author is well and truly over. Now, it's, of course, entirely your personal choice to be like that, but that sort of archetypal myth does not serve authors anymore. It does not. How far you want to go with being available and engaging with people across different mediums and is entirely personal choice. And for me, it's a great deal of fun and it's very rewarding. So it's not a chore at all. But I think you're doing yourself probably a disservice by not being involved to some degree.
Okay. Well, you set up a specific website for Burn Bright and its surrounding books long before the book was released, and you've staffed it with a bunch of other bloggers who seem mostly to be very young, female, for the most part?
We have two males. About to have three. That kind of just evolved. I mean, I was running three websites when I started the Burn Bright website and, you know, I know my limitations in, you know, for a start, me writing content for three websites would be incredibly boring. there's only so much. I'm sure people get sick to death of me as it is anyway. But and I thought, well, really, what do I want to do? And, you know, I think deep down it's sort of indulging my own journalistic, sort of pseudo-journalistic cravings that I might have had as a teenager, because I'm really actually enjoying having a blog where we've got seven writers now and seven writers for Burn Bright will soon be eight, and I have three or four are also writing for the Marianne Delacourt site. What I've done is keep the Marianne de Pierre site a site that I actually do pretty much all the content on, other than having the odd guest blogger on. So there's that side of it. It's been a fun experience for me, as has been the social networking, but also it's been incredibly rewarding because some of the people that I've got writing for me, have got great voices. Belinda, for instance, who does a lot of my tips for dating, you know, she has just got this magic voice that and it's an opportunity for her to air that, you know, possibly because my books might attract more traffic than any other medium she was working on. So she's got a platform there. to express herself and probably get more readership than she would normally, and the same for all the rest of the writers on the site. So it's kind of a win-win thing, which I'm absolutely loving, and they've been just such a pleasure to write, to be involved with all of them, and terribly enthusiastic about Burn Bright, and kept me going, you know, when I've sort of had lapses. So, you know, it's just good. It's just good all round, Tams. It just evolved, and it's worked, and it's been fun. And they all know, and I make this very clear to them at the start, that this is something that should be fun for them, and that if it becomes too busy, the demands become too great, something changes. All they have to do is walk away from it. It's as simple as that, you know. And I certainly be encouraging them to spread their wings and time and do other things. You know, I'm particularly hoping some of them will get opportunities further down the track, and this will have provided them with some kind of writing CV.
So do you discuss content with them ahead of time, or are they pretty much open slather on what they want to write about? And
We do. I have site managers for both sites. Beck Stafford manages the Burn Bright site, and Kylie Fox manages the Delacorte site. And we keep a Google Doc, shared Google Doc, and we run through ideas for content coming up. I mean, a lot of it is very simply literally reviews, and that means sourcing review copies and spreading them around. And I have developed a pathological dislike of the post office, which is quite difficult. we run through lists with Belinda on dating tips and topics for Jamie. You know, he's done things on cyberpunk and gonzo journalism, that kind of thing. Obviously, teeing up interviews. We've got interviewed some great authors, particularly on the Burn Bright site, but we're just starting to do them on the Delacorte site too. And the reception has been fantastic. People are like, you know, I've actually had a couple of authors actually approach me for interviews because they've found the site great and they would like to be associated with it. So, you know, I'm really delighted.
That's excellent. With Burn Bright in particular, obviously the trilogy, if it's going to be a trilogy, it's a finite thing. So what do you see the future of the Burn Bright website and the community once the books are all released and over and you're writing the next thing?
It's a good question, Tansy, and I guess I don't have a definitive answer yet, but in the back of my mind, I have another YA series in mind, which I had actually started writing, fiddling around with a while ago, and although it's actually contemporary, it's a contemporary paranormal fantasy, I guess you would call it. It fits tonally very well with Burn Bright, and I see potentially there I could expand the site to, so they're kind of sister sites. That's one option. The other option is to maybe merge sites eventually, but I guess a lot of that will be dictated by how many people want to stay writing for it, whether we, you know, I have some ideas for directions with it that may or may not work, and so we'll probably review it at the end of the third book and see where we're at. You know, I mean, if it's just not just tonking along, then, you know, maybe that will be it, like many of the things on the internet that just lay idle for years. But I hope not. I hope not, because a lot of energy's gone into it. And, you know, I'd like to see it's a great resource already. There's so many interviews up there, so many reviews up there already. It would be a shame to see it just vanish.
Okay, well, quick update on books 2 and 3 of the Night Creatures trilogy. When are we likely to see the rest of the trilogy? Is there a schedule, or is it still a little bit open?
I don't have exact months, although at the moment Angel Arias is scheduled for the end of this year, November, December, and then possibly around same time the following year. So the second book will come out reasonably quickly, but the third book will take a little bit longer because essentially I haven't written it yet.
I can see how that would slow things down a little.
I'm also writing, I have a contract for 2 more Tara Sharp books, so I will be writing them over the next 2 years as well. So that's kind of why we're sort of working it around those, trying to work it all in. Because I love my Dara Sharp books and, you know, I want to have enough time to do justice to everything. So, yeah, that's the plan at the moment.
Okay. And where does the cowpunk fit into all this?
Well, I, at the moment, have decided that my lovely agent has just had a baby and is on maternity leave until the end of this year. So I'm actually planning to sit on it until she comes back. I've written a fairly large sample, but I don't have a finished book. So, and realistically, couldn't write that book right at this minute. So I think we're just going to put it in our plan for the end of the year to then start thinking about where we might like to try and place it. There is a little secret side project coming out of the cowpunk story, which is actually called Peacemaker. I can't tell you too much about it yet, but that will actually appear before the novel does. And so that's actually, in a sense, that story will already start to be alive before the novel ever comes out. So I'm quite excited about love secret projects. sort of soon as over the next probably 2 months, we'll have those details finalised and I'll be able to talk about it a bit more. So that project is still definitely very alive, both the book and the secret project connected, but just pacing is important. You know, there is such a thing as doing too much.
Really? I'd never have thought that.
You heard me say it, Tansy.
You've also been flirting a little bit with the with a bit more parish placey.
Yeah, I do have a novelette. I'm writing a 10,000-word novelette, which will be an e-book. I'm also actually having a ongoing discussion with a publisher about more parish, but it might take the form of a graphic novel instead of a novel, which I think would adapt very well.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
I'm in conversation with someone about that, but again, that's probably something that will evolve over the next 2 or 3 years, so nothing imminent.
So you're not going to have that much spare time, really, over the next couple of years.
Well, you know, I figure I'm just at that point in my life. My children are sort of, you know, just about to leave the nest, and I have energy still. This is the time to write with vigour and with enthusiasm, and I feel those things for writing. You know, I do. I get excited about it. So why not work hard now and then just see what the future brings?
Fantastic. Now, before we finish up, I didn't want to get through the whole interview without mentioning Glitter Rose, which is
my baby.
Your beautiful collection of short stories, boutique collection of 4 stories that came out about 6 months ago now from 12th Planet Press. I think for most authors, when they start getting novels published, and you wouldn't know anything about, you know, this sort of thing, but finding time for short fiction can be quite difficult. So what was the appeal for you of doing this project?
Several of those stories, well, all of the stories bar one are reprints, so... you know, it's been a long secret desire of mine to have them collected in one book. I just was absolutely ecstatic when Alyssa approached me about them because, you know, everybody knows that short story collections don't, you know, make the bestseller list very often. There are, of course, exceptions to the rule, but generally speaking, they're not the sorts of things that publishers chase. So I had this secret dream, but sort of always felt that it would never be realised. And so I was just so thrilled that someone else loved those stories. Because to me, I don't know, they're the most important short fiction that I've written. I haven't written a heap, but those stories mean so much to me because of the fact that I lived in that place almost. Not quite in Carmen Island, but, you know, in the place that gave me the... the imagination to write the stories. And I don't know, there's just a little piece of my soul in that collection, I think, more so than some, you know, I think there's a little bit of me in everything I write, but very much so in those, in that collection. So, look, I just, it was exciting to have them collected, but then the scary thing, and I'm rambling here, so I'll try and be quick, but the scary thing was to then write a new story when I had written these stories, you know, over a period of, well, I don't know, 6 or 7 years probably, and hadn't written one for a while. And it was like, oh, my God, can I go back and can I recapture this? And I actually went over to Stratty and had a day over there just to think about whether I could do that. And I think, having talked to Alyssa and a few people, and I don't know whether you'd agree, and it's probably putting you on the spot a bit, but I think that last story is actually the best story. I don't know, but I hope it brings closure anyway to the collection. So it was just and working with 12th Planet Press was just absolute joy. I have been so fortunate in my collaborations today. My one with Yu Niu and the one with Alyssa Krasnstein at 12th Planet Press was brilliant. And I would couldn't recommend them more as a an independent publisher to be involved with.
Fantastic.
All sorry, right. Tansy, that was very long-winded.
That's okay. That's what we're here for. I think that just about is come to the end of the interview. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about or plug before we finish up?
Not really. I mean, I think I've talked extensively about myself, so I don't need to anymore. But there is just something that happened today. I wrote Gillian Pollack is running a month of women's, what's she call it, Women's History Month?
Mm-hmm.
And she's invited a whole lot of women to blog, and just literally on whatever they like. And so I was writing my piece today, and the thing that came up for me, and I, because I really had no idea what I was going to write when I sat down to write it, and then without boring you with all the details, I wrote about an incident in my early working experience where I could so desperately have done with a female mentor. And I guess the one thing I would like to say before we finish up is that if there's someone around you, near you, in your vicinity, in your sphere, who you can mentor, do it, because I think that's the only way to make the world a better place.
Oh. Well, I think that's a lovely message to end on. Marianne, thank you for talking to me. It's been a real pleasure, and we don't do this nearly enough.
We don't. Thank you, darling. It was a pleasure too.
Good night.
Bye.